Welcome back to Switchcast Season 5. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt, here with my co-host, Tyler Sanders, and our venerable producer, Ethan Huffnagel. I have no idea what venerable means, but I've heard that used in other contexts that are the same, and I'm a homeschooler, so I use large words to seem pretentious. Well, that's what my wife tells me anyway. So
I would look it up, but I don't have service out here, so we're out here in the boonies.
Yes, you can tell that this is not live, because, yeah. Anyway, we appreciate you being here. We are Switchcast is the automotive entertainment show that's not just for car people. In fact, it's better if you're not a car person because then you can't call us out for our mistakes as easily. We've got some fun stuff tonight, and we are going to start with another market update. Is the car market or the high-end car market crashing? We see videos on TikTok all the time. You see lots of things on TikTok, how to be a real estate bro, a crypto bro, you know.
There's lots of bros happening.
Exotic car hacks.
Bro.
Stuff like that. But you also see real inflammatory headlines and short videos about, you know, repo lots and stuff like that. And is the car market really crashing? And then you go on Bring a Trailer, everybody's favorite online auction website, and you see one or two bad results, and you see people opining that, oh, the market's crashing because of this one data point. And this is something we've talked about before, but I think it warrants talking about again, and in particular, because just a couple weeks ago, Broad Arrow Auctions, which is a subsidiary of Hagerty, has launched their inaugural auction at the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival, which is a growing and popular event down in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
I will say, it looks like something we might need to start going to because we had a couple of friends there and it looked awesome.
I've heard it is a great event, yes. So, of course, you have the panache of a big name auction and associated with the event that helps to grow it. But a first outing is always a little bit of a risk. They had some good cars. They had some mediocre cars, just like any other auction. So we wanted to unpack that a little bit and compare it against some Bring a Trailer statistics and anecdotes and see if we can glean anything useful from that to make better decisions buying and selling and maybe put to bed the myth or not myth of is the exotic car market crashing for this month anyway. And then we'll be back next month because it'll be a hot topic.
Could change next week.
Yes. Yes. So they had 91 vehicles at this auction, smaller, a little bit more curated auction, not the thousands of cars that go through Barrett Jackson. And their sell-through rate was 73%, which seems a little bit low, but that's not counting deals made after the fact. So their published sell-through rate as of today was 82%. So that included deals that closed, not, you know, not at the hammer, but post auction.
How does this compare to, like, we've been going to Amelia for the past few years and things seem pretty successful there when you're in the room, which is part of the smoke and mirrors, I imagine, but
sure.
Is that relatively normal?
Yep. 82% is kind of right on the money. There's some auctions that boast into the 90s, but that's typically a one-off or maybe an extra successful auction. Barrett Jackson, of course, is 100% sell-through rate because they require everything to be no reserve. And there's an interesting dichotomy that people, when analyzing this, will look at. They'll look at the sell-through rate of reserve cars and compare those metrics against each other because they say, well, no reserve cars don't count because they're all selling. I don't know that I like that comparison. I think you got to look at the numbers themselves because over time, those sell-through rates have stayed generally the same across all of the auction platforms and have not varied significantly. I think the auction houses themselves are fairly up on what the market is doing, so they're going to require a reserve to be set in line with current market conditions. So a sell-through or non-sell-through rate is not necessarily directly indicative of what the market is doing up or down. The metric that I found interesting was the percentage of cars that did not even reach the low estimate.
Yes, that was something that stood out to me almost immediately. You said, hey, check this out. Look at all these cars. I'm flicking through. There's some interesting cars in there. There's ones that I think I'd like to call out. But like that was what drew my attention immediately.
Yep. And side note, this is a quip from our friend John Sabo. He was making fun of the big auction houses, I think we all do, for their ginormous estimates, right? The range is, if we were in physics class or something, they'd never allow this margin of error. We'd get an F on our paper. You know, it's this car is estimated between 250 and 350,000. Well, no kidding.
Yeah, it's like, I think the weathermen are even jealous of the bandwidth that they give themselves or the margin of error. Like, it's insanity. Oh, 1.5 to 2.2 million. Sure.
Yeah, like, yeah. I have to be way better at my job than that. But anyway, that's I understand that the bidding can go very well or not well at all, depending on conditions, but at least give us a more accurate idea of what you really think the car is going to sell for under normal conditions. However, 73% of cars, whether they sold or did not sell, did not bid to the low estimate.
Oof.
73%. 8% of cars hammered at the low estimate. So add those two together, 81% of cars were at or below the low estimate. Now, typically in an auction, you want to have kind of like a box and whisker plot, right? So you have a majority of cars selling in between the low and the high. You have outliers on both sides. You have some selling way above the high and some selling below the low, and those kind of all offset. And, you know, you have a nice bell curve in a sense.
For sure.
Well, this was a reverse hockey stick if you put it on a graph. So that spoke to me in terms of, ooh, this is a bit concerning.
Or?
Well, again, we have to look at it. One, it was their first year. It was a first year auction. So they may not have had the audience that they wanted. It's not an established sale. That can impact things. Although with virtual bidding, online bidding, right? Everybody in their bidder list gets the catalog. Anybody can bid from anywhere. But I want to highlight a few things within the auction itself and kind of take a look at, you know, certain segments that may have been impacted more or less.
Something I would like to call out is there was an S2000 in this auction. I don't know if this is the first time that an S2000 has been in a bigwig, hoity-toity kind of auction, but I got depressed. It is an S2000. They're fantastic. They're wonderful, but at an auction?
I think I've seen a delivery mile S2000 CR at one of the auctions.
That, I allow that.
Not this a regular one.
This relatively normal. I think it was hyper low mileage, but like, boah, this is when I start to feel old.
Yes.
Dear listeners.
So let's call out a few of them. So there was a 2023 Z06 convertible with a high sticker price. I think it was 155 sticker, 200 miles, and it bid to 125. That's 30 grand below sticker. Rewind to our discussion a couple weeks ago, specifically about the Z06 market, and the person who wanted thought we were way off by bidding 35K below sticker. Well, this was a retail high-end auction sale, and it didn't sell at 30 below. I think this guy should have taken the 125 bid because it is not getting better from there. It is not. They are going down in value.
He's hanging on to a sinking ship.
Yes. Another standout was a 2015 Aston Martin DB9 Coupe. I think this is the depreciation special of this year. The estimate was 65 to 85. It sold for 47.5. Now we're talking about hammer price here. We're using the hammer price app. We're not talking about what you see published on the auction website, which includes the buyer's fees. We're talking the actual hammer bid, because I think that's more accurate because that's halfway in between what the seller nets and what the buyer pays. That car, so it sold for 47.5. That car sold earlier this year, I believe it was. Man, there's a bunch of transactions. It's made its rounds. 2018, it was listed for 115. 2021, it was listed for 100. 2022, it was listed for 96K. January of 2023, it was listed for $90,000. March of 2024, it was listed again for $74,500. So this thing just keeps going down in value. But whoever bought it earlier this year probably paid around $70,000 and net about $42,000. So they almost cut that in half.
Oh, brutal.
Used exotic cars are not good investments.
Every time something like this happens, I just hope in my soul that this is when we start realizing that these things are not investments, but I know it's not going to, this is just a blip.
1996 Bentley Azure with 9,200 miles in racing green over tan. Oh. Estimate was 50 to 70K, sold for 32.5. Oh. If that car was clean, that was the score of the auction.
Man.
I wanted to point out as well the kind of standouts. The newer Porsches, right? Didn't we talk about new GT3 RSs being the ones to maybe be the next bubble? So all of the newer, quote-unquote, modern collectible Porsches all were below the low estimate.
I also didn't realize that the 991 GT2 RSs were so much money.
Yep.
That's not a market I really pay attention to. I don't roll in that kind of cash. But whoa! But even then, significantly below the low estimate.
Correct. 911 Dakar, 2018 991 GT2 RS, 2019 Porsche Speedster, and a 2023 GT3 RS Tribute Edition, all below the low estimate.
But the older Porsches, there's a couple of like 80s 911s, there's a turbo look cab, there's a turbo cab, but like all of those did pretty well.
Yep.
Including this ridiculous 996. I think the listeners are going to think I only pay attention to 996s, but this is so crazy. It is a Carrera 4 that was done up by Gimbala. Is that how you pronounce it, Gimbala?
Sure.
It's gray.
Juve.
Eye-searing red interior. It's the narrow-body Carrera 4 that they sort of made look like a turbo and then put a turbo engine in. Somebody paid over $100,000 for this, for a 996.
Yeah.
That is not a GT.
There was also a 2011 Audi R8 manual V10 coupe in red, 7,100 miles. That should be a 150K car. The estimate was 120 to 140, a high bid to 105. I think this is a good picture. You could look at that and say the R8 market is crashing. But if you look at actual recent transactions, that is way out of bounds and not indicative of the R8 market. And if you look up that car itself, it has a little bit of a sketchy history. So it's not a primo example. And I think some people were nervous of the car because of that. So that's just one example of how you can't take an individual transaction and apply it to the overall market in general. But yeah, was a lot of deals there.
What about that purple 6.0?
Yeah, there was a Viola Ophelia. Oh. I was Ophelia-ing it. Yeah,
so good.
I would love to get rid of my orange one for a purple one. That one, high bid to $540,000, and it sold after the auction for an undisclosed sum.
Look, I think orange is one of the peak colors for a 6.0, but this purple is something else.
Here's the fun part of it. So they did not disclose what it sold for, but on Broad Arrow's website, they listed the sales from high to low dollar amount. And the one above the Diablo sold for $593, inclusive of buyer's premium, which is, I believe, 10% above $250K. So you're looking at about $50,000. So if it sold with the buyer's premium for less than that, arguably, it would have either had to have sold for the high bid or for less than the high bid.
That is, whoa. Yeah, that's wild.
Because if it's a 10% buyer's premium, that would be $54,000. That would put it above $593,000. So someone I know had the theory that it got bid up artificially and then they sold it to the underbidder for less than the high bid. Again, that's just speculation. but it's certainly interesting that it high bid to 540 and then, you know, sold for maybe less than the high bid.
Yeah. Interesting.
These things can happen. We don't always know why, but they can happen.
I think in summary, though, it does seem like there continues to be some level of cooling on the broad strokes after Broad Arrow. It's not significant.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, it's not like things are crashing. Crashing is bold, but there still seem to things are not, you know, gangbusters every auction.
Sure. The other point I want to make is whenever we talk about this, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that people offer. And the most common one is, oh my gosh, look at all the reserve not met on Bring a Trailer, because that's kind of a spectator sport. Everybody can watch. The problem is we now have, or Bring a Trailer now has, I don't know why I said we as the audience, now have over 100 auctions per day to watch on Bring a Trailer. So if you look at their actual stats, their sell-through rate is not changing, but because they are have so many more auctions, there's going to be more reserve not met as well. The statistics show that there aren't any more on a percentage-wise that are not meeting reserve. So that's not a valid observation from an anecdotal perspective. But in general, I think the market needs to cool, right? So
100%.
Anecdotally, and I think this is true on the super, super high end, right? All the bajillion million-dollar cars are getting out of control. I feel like that market's saturated. I might be wrong. There's 23 or 21 million millionaires in the US. Like, that's a lot. There's a lot of money to go around. But I got offered a Roof CTR, which is the Yellow Bird. It wasn't the Yellow Bird, but that's what we're talking about here. For $4.5 million.
What?
That is a glorified G-body 911.
Yeah.
I am way oversimplifying it and probably going to offend some people. I love Roofs. I love, love, love. They're my favorite. I shouldn't say tuner, but they're not what's coach.
They're like a coach builder, but they also coach build the engines.
Yes, and they have their own bins, and they are a manufacturer. But you look at it, and it's a 911, right?
Yeah.
It is a 911. They're rare. They have an incredible history. I get it. But take a step back. Take some of that out of it and go, I could have a Ferrari F50 or a 911.
I am probably really close to being a Porsche fanboy if I'm not already, and I'd still take the Ferrari. My goodness.
I have a fake roof over here that's cost me like $100,000. So anyway,
wildly different.
Yeah. It's a tribute. It's yes. Anyway, that brings us to our wall of shame of the week, which we're revising a little bit. So we get a lot of, mean comments. Well, most of them are directed at me.
Thank God.
Yes. And they come in all shapes and sizes, some of them in good humor, some of them not. So we thought we would address them in the style of mean tweets, right? So we'll read our own mean comments and respond to them. And since it's the mean tweet of the week, I thought I'd just shorten it and call it the mean tweak. So we're gonna bring in a mean tweak. This was on my ever and continuingly controversial Transporter fail video where I called out a bad transporter and made fun of him, and boy have I gotten a lot of flack for that one. So Ethan, what do we got off of that video?
Grow up. You sound like a 2-year-old complaining. The car is gonna get there just fine.
Yes, the you're a childish Karen. Yes. Okay. Maybe not. If you use a bad transporter, the car may get there just fine. But as I've said before, and I'll say it again, a man with an experience is not at the mercy of a man with an opinion. So there's a lot of people on the internet with an opinion about it. And ironically, somebody posted on the same video very shortly after that they were quoted $600 to ship a car and they paid the broker up front. The car arrived late, which goes without saying.
Standard.
Then the driver demanded $1,200 to unload the car.
Who?
Right?
Ooh.
Probably because the broker never paid the driver itself. So it may not have even been a driver trying to like scam him or both. I don't know. But, you know, okay, that's a real experience. That's something that happened to somebody versus these people that just go off on the internet and say that I'm an idiot because I complain about people screwing other people over and being terrible at their job.
But still, it's like we've talked about so many times with these transporters, like especially if you're transporting some high-end exotic car, some sports car, is it worth saving $1,000? To,
I mean, yes, $1,000, but we're talking like $100 or $200. But even that's even saving.
Like, but you want to make sure your car gets there, and it's like how much risk is it? Is it worth it? Probably not.
Yes.
Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
We talked a couple weeks ago about CPR Classic and the millions of dollars that they have stolen from their clients. I'm not even going to say allegedly anymore because, I mean, their doors are closed, they are shut down, and the stories that are coming out are many and terrible. And after the story, I actually heard from a couple of my customers who had active lawsuits and or judgments against CPR Classics, and the stories were awful. One of them is owed $600,000 by CPR.
Wow.
He sent them a car for restoration or for some work to get done, and they sold it. The other customer, the opposite thing, he bought a car with a restoration. Turns out the car wasn't even for sale. It was somebody else's car, and they sent him fake photos of the restoration being done, and it wasn't actually being done.
Oh.
It was still in parts, and he ended up helping the actual owner of the car, like, get the parts out of there before the whole place got shut down. But he has a judgment against them, which is worth the paper that it's printed on, unfortunately. But it's just bad. They are, it's terrible. So anyway, we thought, okay, well, how do you protect yourself against these kinds of scams, right? So a lot of people said, wow, that's a consignment business model. It's a scam. No, it is an easy formula for a scam, certainly, but it is not. There's plenty of very reputable consignment dealers out there. The only time it becomes a scam is when the dealers spend more money than they make and start using your money to do other things, or using your money to try to make more money by essentially leveraging that float or your vehicle title to get loans to buy inventory, thinking, oh, we can like essentially make more money than just the consignment cars we have here. There was a dealer up in Mentor, Best of Show, I think, that was accused of doing exactly that. A friend of mine was working there when the FBI showed up and yeah, they were, I think, basically taking consignment cars, using their titles to get floor plan money as if they owned them, and then using that floor plan money to buy different cars.
Oof.
Great game if it works, if you make money on all of them. But
the problem is with all this stuff, as soon as one card falls, everything goes with it.
Correct.
It's so risky.
The other problem, and this was from a commenter on the video, I thought this was incredibly profound, because again, it's not that hard to make money in this business. Like, you got to kind of try to lose a lot of money to pull off a scheme like this and owe people millions and millions of dollars. The problem that he identified, I think is right, is that most of these dealers try to live the same lifestyle as their clients.
Ah,
I think that's right dead on the money. And even if you look at CPR Classics, one of the family was racing fancy Porsches at a high level. And that is an incredibly expensive hobby. So again, if you try to keep up with your clients, like, you just can't. There isn't enough money in this business typically. The old saying goes, sell to the classes, eat with the masses, sell to the masses, eat with the classes. So if you're selling to extremely rich people, likely you're not going to have the same lifestyle as they are, but if you're around it all the time, it's addictive. You think you are deserving of that lifestyle, entitled to it. And yeah, that's the beginning of the end. Anyway, let's talk about some ways you can protect yourself, maybe against getting screwed by consignment dealers. One, check out their online reviews. It's decent. It's not perfect, but if you filter by most recent, it only takes one really bad one to go, there may be something awry here.
Well, and I think too, something to call out is, you know, when you're looking for restaurants and you see somebody leave a one star and it's just like, ah, the server was slow and didn't, like, okay, you can ignore those. If you're looking at a car dealership where you're spending thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, take the one star seriously if they seem to have any sort of meat to them.
Yeah. Read it though. Why?
Yes. Well, yeah. Yes. Read it. Why? Don't just ignore, you know.
Yep. The difficult part is I've heard of dealers threatening or enticing their clients monetarily to remove those reviews, essentially paying them off. So that's not perfect either. But if you find one, usually where there's smoke, there's fire. That may be the tip of the iceberg. So forums. The forums are great. Mm. People will air their grievances there. And a lot of times it's not like, I got screwed. It's more of a soft, is anyone else having this experience? I've had a little bit of trouble. Been, you know, some delays and stuff. I'm not sure. So take those. Those are big, big red flags, because I've seen a lot of stuff on forums early on before it became really public. So that's a good early way to find out whether or not people have had good experiences. Additionally, you could post there. And or even, a lot of times people will DM you because they don't want to get sued for defamation or whatever. So they're not going to post it publicly. But if there's shady stuff going on, you will get messages.
Well, that's what I was saying, is like, you can message somebody who seems to have a weird problem and you can kind of talk together and share more, maybe more privately over a phone call. And who knows what information you'll get at
absolutely.
That point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ask for references. And for references of people that have done transactions within the last 60 days, right? It doesn't matter how long a company's been around or how long you've done business with them personally. They are only as good as their last 60 days, right? Bernie Madoff made a lot of people a lot of money for a long time before that money ceased to exist. So you want fresh, recent transactions. You know, did you sell a car with them last week? Yes. Are you paid? Yes. Okay. Probably a good indicator that that's okay. If you can get lender references, that's great, because they're typically the front line of when things are going wrong. They are the first people not to get paid, because banks and lenders are not going to spew it all over the internet. They're just going to file a civil lawsuit, and that's going to take a bunch of time and nobody's going to find out about it. But if you're able, if you have industry connections in order to actually find out what lender they're using, because like CNC Exotics, long before anything hit the internet, Next Gear Capital, who held their floor plan, went in and repoed all their cars. Somebody knew about that, and that started the rumors. So that was a very early indicator that there was something wrong. You can play detective, county, state court search for civil cases. Look up the Secretary of State to look at their business status. Call the DMV, check for complaints, stuff like that. Be your own detective. Again, lawsuits on this type of thing are typically delayed because that's people's last line of defense. But it's certainly something you can check, and check the owner and check their history. Maybe they have a different company and they screwed other people over. So check their personal lawsuit history as well, not just this particular company that they happen to have. Now, if you're selling, don't give them the title until you have cash in hand. I mean, wire transfer cash, not a check, not a tracking number of a check, wire transfer only, because CPR Classics sent people checks that bounced. They sent people tracking numbers that were fake. They sent people empty envelopes. Like,
wait, did they empty envelopes?
Yes.
What?
Yes. So did CNC Exotics.
Wild.
Yeah. If you do get screwed, if you are not paid within 14 days, take legal and regulatory action immediately. I can't stress this enough. So many people give bad people so much time to try to make it right. And you give up your chances of recourse by waiting too long, right? And I think you're also screwing over future clients, right? And I think it's ultimately because people hold out hope. And I think it's selfish, because people will say like, well, if I don't make it public, the company will keep doing business and I'll get paid. But that money, you're getting paid with somebody else's money. And I think people know that. They just don't want to be the one that gets screwed.
Yeah. They're like, well, if somebody else, you know, it's not my fault if somebody else gets screwed.
Yeah. Ugh. But if you know, you know, and not saying something publicly or taking immediate legal action is allowing the fraud to continue. And, you know, in any lawsuit, typically like, or like bad situation like this, the earlier you get in and get your claim in, the more likely you'll get something out of it. So don't wait. Don't buy people's excuses. If your car is sold, you should be paid in a week or two. Just like, that's it. That's it. A couple notes. So Sports Car Market covered the article here about CPR Classic. And the author of this article went into some safe practices to do when you're buying or selling a car. And they talked about using an attorney for an escrow. They talked about essentially, if it's consignment, don't do the deal with the dealer. Ask them to do it with the customer directly, with the seller directly. You exchange funds with them and then pay the consigning dealer separately their commission. Again, use an attorney for an escrow and don't have the attorney release the funds until you have the title. In theory, that's good, but it's not necessarily practical. For one, there are some laws that prohibit consignment dealers from backing out of the transaction, from allowing the parties to do it individually. By law, the consignment dealer has to do the transaction. So they'd be in violation of their state laws if they do that. Two, in Ohio, we have to physically put the title into our name and then transfer the title in Ohio to the buyer. So waiting for somebody to pay us until we've put the title in their name, like that could take a couple weeks. We have to float the money for the consignor. We have to pay them, obviously, because they want to be protected. We got to give them their money to get the title. Then we got to flip it into the buyer's name. That means the buyer has the car and the title in their name and we're not paid.
Yeah.
Like, yes, it's an escrow. We legally have to get paid, but I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah.
So yes, these are things you should do in an ideal world to protect yourself, but a lot of dealers are not going to go along with that stuff, and for good reason.
Oof.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, like, so I'm thinking over here, is there any way, like, does a dealer have to disclose that they're consigning a vehicle? Could they not?
It's like, not in their benefit to hide that they are.
Okay.
We're open about it. And, you know, we'll send people a copy of the title and all the documentation they require. But we're not sending out a title before we get paid. So
for sure.
Yeah. It's ultimately there has to be some level of trust, but the biggest thing is do your due diligence before you do the transaction. And escrow is not necessarily the best way for all parties. It might be the best way for the buyer. But if you have to use an escrow, you didn't do your homework properly. It's kind of my opinion about it. Because if somebody comes to us and says, I want to do an escrow, it's just, nope, not happening. Not happening. Well, speaking of scams, let's check out the Scaminator and see what we can find. There's a for sale ad on Marketplace, and we're going to try to figure out if this is a scam or not.
Alrighty, Doug. This is for a 2022 Toyota Highlander. Much newer than stuff we normally talk about.
Yeah, my wife found this one. She's car shopping.
Ah, there it is. It comes out. LE Sport Utility, four-door. Thank you. Description. Notes title showing not actually, but it is actually mile, because when I bought it, it was stationary, so the insurance company, they don't turn it on to figure the mile. That's all I got.
That's a whole description.
Mm-hmm. Oh, $27,000. I don't know if that's reasonable or not for one of these.
Okay, so title. Well, I don't know if this is a scam per se, but it's definitely shady. So, one, you got to read into it. I mean, tell us something else about the car, right? Like something you do want to know, not just apologize for the TMU title. If came from an insurance company, that probably means it was wrecked previously. So I would be less worried about the non-actual mileage title than about what happened to the car.
Yeah.
So I did actually look up the VIN on Epic VIN, and it showed the previous auction sale.
Okay.
And it showed that the car had been rear-ended. I was fully expecting this thing to be a rebuilt title car because that's the only reason the insurance company would sell it at auction. It was not. It was actually fairly minor damage. It was a clean title other than the non-actual mileage brand. And in these photos, there was a photo of the odometer. The car was on. So that whole thing about insurance companies not turning the car on is not true. I think somebody just made a clerical error and
that's weird.
Definitely a red flag there, thinking it should be a salvage title or it might be a scam. This one is not actually a scam. He's like kind of right. It might be a half decent buy,
but you're like coming out of the gate
seller.
Yeah. You're coming out of the gate with an excuse. It's not like, here's why this car is good. Here's why it's a deal. It's not the title's weird. Here's why.
If it was a Porsche on Marketplace, they would tell you all about all the options and how rare it was and how amazing. And they're such a great owner. And then at the bottom, a little footnote, it was a non-actual miles total.
Yeah. It's like, just hand wave that away. Shove it under the rug. Doesn't matter.
This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine. Get yours at SheffieldWatches.com and mention that you heard about them on Switchcast. There is a viral video this week everywhere of a bicyclist and a young driver having an altercation. And I'm sure you've seen it. If not, well, go look it up. Gary Peacock, a 73-year-old man in Park City, Utah, was riding his bicycle, and young man Pierce Kempton drove by him in his Subaru on the way to the skate park. This is Park City, Utah. Man, there's so many stereotypes being fulfilled here. And apparently did not give him the requisite 3 feet that's required. So Gary pulled into the skate park behind the young man and proceeded to berate him verbally. And the young kid was, I mean, it was great. He actually was like super composed. He got out his phone and started filming immediately because Gary came right up to his window, just hot and angry, and just talking about how like awful this kid was, that he almost hit him, all these different things. And wouldn't let the kid leave. And the kid's like, dude, I'm just going to go skate, which the Gary knew the lingo, and he thought that meant, oh, well, then I'm trying to leave. Like, I'm going to skate.
Oh,
but he's literally at a skate park.
Yeah.
So he like forced open his door multiple times. Gary did. And wouldn't let the kid leave. He's like, I'm going to call the cops. You have to stay here until then. Trying to get the kid's name and his license and all this stuff. Like, basically playing cop, trying to detain this kid.
Yeah, it was wild to watch.
Yeah. And then one of Pierce's friends came by, and Pierce is like, hey, can you just, like, stand here? Because I don't know what's going on. And Gary took that to be a threat. Yeah, so while he's on the phone with the police, he's going, these two kids are being aggressive and they're being threatening by standing near me and stuff. And Ben Pierce is like, dude, you need to give me space. Like, I can't even get out of my car. So,
gosh. And he was so worried. He's like, well, yeah, there's another kid there. It feels like they're ganging up on me or something. It was wild to watch.
Right. And this went on for a number of minutes until the cops finally showed up. And, just the things he was saying both to the kid and to the cops were absolutely insane. He was asking if he could have him arrested. He told the kid, I'm on a bicycle, so, quote, I have more rights than you.
There it is. Which
that should trigger a whole lot of us who are fed up with the certain type of bicyclists on the road. That one got me. So the cops arrived and Gary, the bicyclist, goes over to the cop and immediately identifies himself as the complainant. And the cop, I commend him for his attitude. The first word out of his mouth was fantastic.
And you know, you're going to get into it. I just got to say, I was so happy to see a video on the internet of, like, this cop did a great job, I think. He de-escalated the situation. He kept everybody separate. Like, I'm so used to, like, so many people trying to be inflammatory one way or the other about cops that this was just somebody doing his job and kind of fed up with what was going on.
Right.
He was like, oh, like, you just know he's going to go back to the station and, like, I don't know.
Honestly, Gary kind of, like, reminded me of the typical, like, angry sheriff that escalates the situation and doesn't do his job and ends up getting the department sued. But, you know, the cop that showed up was, super professional, separated them, got the stories. And Gary was, I mean, just when Gary was talking to the cop, right? So we watched the kid's video that he took, then you watch the body cam. And Gary is just lying through his teeth. He's completely inconsistent in what he's telling the cop in terms of what happened and just even his complaints. He's asking if he could have the kid arrested. And the cop's like, on your testimony? Like, no.
And he's all over the place. He, like, can't keep his story straight. He's, like, referencing other things. Like, he's not ever talking about what actually happened.
Yeah.
He's just talking about how upset he is with the kid.
Yeah. So then the cop goes, talks to the kid, watches the kid's phone of what actually happened. And the cop just kind of, like, starts laughing. He goes back to Gary and tells him what Gary did. He's like, dude, you forced open his door multiple times. No, I didn't. He's like, I watched the video. And so anyway, poetic justice happened. And Gary, the old man, was issued a ticket, a misdemeanor for disorderly conduct. And he was so mad. He was so mad. And he then said, like, well, what if I apologize?
Nope.
Which I'm like, dude, that's not a real apology at that point. That is literally, I don't want this consequence, so I want to go apologize to try to get out of it. At no point up until that point did he want to make an apology.
Nope.
That is not an apology. I have an 8-year-old boy. We're trying to teach him this. Like, that's not a real apology.
It's like, this guy could use a bit of a refresher course.
Yes. Yeah. The dash cam was submitted. So the kid also got a $130 ticket for whatever the violation was, being too close to, I think, a vulnerable vehicle or something like that. And he submitted the dash cam, and the prosecutor immediately dropped the charges and emailed him like, yep, this is totally exculpatory. So you're good.
Nice.
You're cleared. So he did not get a ticket, which he didn't do anything wrong, obviously. And, you know, the whole internet world got to witness this instant karma, right?
So satisfying.
So satisfying.
What is that word? Schadenfreude, I think, is the German word for joy at someone else's misfortune or something like that. Like, ooh, it was so good.
That was so good. But we want to talk about a few things here, right? We don't need to. That was just a summary of what happened. You can watch the video yourself. It is absolutely worth wasting 45 minutes to watch it. It's so good. First of all, Gary Peacock, what an absolutely apropos name, right?
That's, my goodness.
Oh, yes. Whew. Yes. it was noted in one article that Gary Peacock was a millionaire, which, duh, he's in Park City. You have to be to live there. But a lot of people suggested that this kid should file a civil lawsuit against Gary, which I just want to say right off the bat, please, please, no. That is the worst idea. As soon as you do that, you're becoming the Karen that everybody's ticked at Gary for being, right? Like, yes. I think back to the French Revolution. And when that happened, the oppressed became the oppressors, right? They overthrew the ruling class and then, like, didn't stop there. It didn't become equitable anymore. Then they just would, like, murder people just because they were wives or children or anybody associated with that class. And the saying came out of that, don't become that which you hate. And if this kid files a civil lawsuit against Gary, that is becoming that which you hate. There's absolutely no reason. You're not emotionally scarred because this guy, you know, was angry at you for 10 minutes or whatever. Like, you got your justice.
Yes.
Gary has already, like, if anything, Gary should file a lawsuit against himself for defamation of character, right? He's already punished himself enough. And, like, let it go, right? Enjoy the moment, laugh at it. I will be really upset with this kid if he files a civil lawsuit. Not that he cares what I think.
No, but it's like justice was served. The system worked. Let's celebrate that. Enjoy the moment, like you said, and just kind of move on. There's no reason to continue it. It's so happy to have it end like this.
Yes. Yeah. But I think a lot of us love this, right? Because we are all tired of bikers wanting equal or special rights as Gary thought, you know, he was entitled to. This whole share the road mentality, but then violating all the laws that are in place to keep them safe.
Just 2 days ago, I saw a bicyclist blow through a stop sign at a four-way stop and, like, make a turn and cross the road, and they were riding on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah.
It was wild.
Yeah, it is wild. And again, it's one thing if you're going to do that. It's another thing if you're then going to, as the biker, get mad at every car that's slightly too close to you or doesn't give you a full lane to pass or any number of these things, and then you are just completely ignoring all of the rules. Like, these are laws for your safety. We are in 2-ton steel tanks, right?
Yes. You do not win. I don't know what what you think you have. You don't win.
You might win the civil lawsuit, but you're going to get wheeled into the courtroom. So, and like, I got nothing against bikers. A lot of my friends do it seriously and I respect them. And, you know, the guys that I see, like, stop at the stop signs and act as if they are a car. I want to get out and give them a high five. Be like, thank you for contributing to your own safety and helping me keep you safe, right? I'll give them all the space they need. But it's this attitude that these bikers have where they'll ride in these huge groups on roads where they're supposed to ride single file, and then you can't get around them. And, you know, again, they all get mad at you. And it's like,
and it's always, and I'm going to be slightly petty here. You're being very upstanding, I think, in this moment, talking in general. Around here where we live, it is always on the only nice twisty roads that exist that they are in packs of like 20.
With no shoulder.
No shoulder. They're supposed to be in single file. Like, you, it's bad enough when there's like cops or traffic and you're just trying to have a good time, not even be too much of a hooligan. And they're just in the way every time, all the time. And they're around corners in the middle. Like, even if you're driving this below the speed limit on some of these corners and you come around and there's a whole gaggle of them, it's like dangerous. I've had to slam on my brakes a couple of times, and not because I was like driving crazy. It was, again, below the speed limit, around a turn, and just bam.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think though, we've all been on Gary's side before too.
Are you a closet cyclist, Doug?
No, I'm a closet Karen.
Oh,
right. So I think everybody identified with this video so much because we all share this frustration with bikers completely ignoring rules about sharing the road and just expecting cars to give them the right of way. And also the fact that in most states, cars are at a legal disadvantage. If anything happens between a car and a bike, it pretty much defaults to the person in the car is at fault. And that's very, very frustrating. But I've chased people down, followed them, called the cops on them, talked to them about times when they've done dangerous things on the road as well. Just the other day, somebody was on their phone, crossed the center line. I did a U-ey. I caught up to them at a stoplight, asked them to roll their window down, and we had a conversation. Now, there's two important differences, right? One, it's fine to be a Karen if you're right.
Ooh, hot take.
If you're right. Tonight.
Okay.
Now, my transporter videos, I'm right. People still get angry at me, whatever. People will always be angry at you for being a Karen. But if you are right, then you can be a Karen. You can be a narc, right? Like, we want to be safe on the roads. And if someone's really doing something dangerous, the cops can't always get to them. Let's have a chat, right?
I don't believe you also walked up and started ripping on their door and berating them and like a whole other business.
I was not bordering on assault or kidnapping, trying to illegally detain somebody as a private citizen, right?
Yeah, that's not how that works.
There's so many other things that Gary could have been charged with. And it's interesting to note too, that in one of the articles, the prosecutor said, because Gary was charged with, gosh darn it, what was he charged with? Whatever ticket he got, the misdemeanor. Anyway, the case was closed, so additional charges could not be brought. So if the kid had said, like, oh, I want to press charges for assault or kidnapping or whatever, if that was even possible, like, you know, it was done, right? The case was closed, that was over, like, you know, and that's probably just fine. But no, you're right. When I have talked to people, I have either let the cops do their job, call the cops, follow them as long as it was safe or reasonable to do so, and then let it go. But honestly, nobody wants dangerous people on the road, right? Everyone enjoys instant karma when someone runs a red light in front of a cop.
Oh, yeah, so right? Good. Or when we're on the highway and somebody blows past you and then gets pulled over like a mile up the road by a cop who was waiting. Nope, not that. Okay.
Nothing wrong with speeding. No, I'm that guy who blows past people. So speeding, that's not unsafe though, necessarily. Like, I get it, right? But like, I think all of us on the internet have to realize that there's a little bit of Gary in us, right? We love the instant karma, but we also want to be that Karen. But the point is whether or not what somebody was doing was actually unsafe and whether or not we were right. The problem with Gary's complaint is he was totally wrong and he just, like, he couldn't let it go. 15 minutes talking to the cop, he was still angry. He was still making stuff up, trying to get this kid jailed. He just, like, he couldn't just go up to the kid and say, this was a problem, I got a problem, and please be more safe, and then let it go, right? So I think that's the second important point, right? There's a line that you can cross when being a Karen becomes like
a Gary,
bad or dangerous or whatever.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you're putting yourself into. And that was the cop's point. It's like, we've gotten called to situations like this where there's a dead body because somebody had to air their grievance and it ended differently.
For sure. You never know what anybody's got on them physically. You don't know what they're carrying with them mentally that day, what kind of state they're in. So, like, I agree that I would love a safer road. And if a discussion can be had to kind of call somebody out and make them feel some of that guilt is like, ooh, I did mess up without it escalating, I'm all for it.
But yeah. Well, and if Gary had simply done that, this would be a non-story. It wouldn't have gone viral. Right. No. It would have been over and done with. But he just couldn't let it go. And so that's why we have a fun story. But the funny thing was, too, it's ironic in all these videos, of course, his sob biker shirt.
Man, was
front and center.
I was so sad.
It like, really is a sob story. Yeah. If Sob wasn't bankrupt, they probably would have sued him as well for defamation of their brand by him wearing this shirt.
R.I.P. Saab. We love a good Swedish car brand, even though they're less than Swedish now. I'm wearing my Prancing Moose shirt, indeed, which is not officially Volvo, but close enough.
That brings us to the props and flops.
which as always is brought to you by Switch Cars. Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, and consign only cars that we like ourselves. Check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention Switchcast for special pricing. Find more information at switchcars.com or come visit our showroom in beautiful Twinsburg, Ohio. Doug, what do we got for our pick of the week?
1983 Chevrolet K10 4x4 Silverado in excellent original condition, two-tone, and 12,000, we believe, original miles. This thing is a time capsule.
That's nuts.
Pretty awesome. Yep. Yep. Prop of the week. Speaking of Saabs, Nick Kruger and his team, who previously held the coast-to-coast-to-coast cannonball record and had it beaten by 9 minutes, went out this past weekend and beat the record again by over 3.5 hours.
Whoa.
61 hours, 59 minutes, coast to coast to coast. Double cannonballs. I mean, ball. Yeah. So they were stinking hauling. Two other records were set this past couple weekends. There was a 30-hour, one-minute rental car record. Boy, what they would do for 2 minutes off their time.
So close.
Yes, the EV record was set again. It's not officially been released yet, but it is finally under 40 hours. It's the first EV record under 40 hours, but it is still 1 minute slower than a time set by a short bus. So, you know, we're not there yet, EV technology.
Context is important.
Yes. And of course, the coast-to-coast-to-coast record was about like 17 records all in one, right? So they, you know, with all these nuanced records, speaking of Swedish cars, so they did set the Swedish car record. They also set the foreign car record that was owned by a GM. Or American conglomerate. They also set the non-existent manufacturer award, like the defunct manufacturer one. They set the first leg of a double continental record. They set the second leg of a double transcontinental record as well. Well, each of those vehicle records, the Swedish car records, actually three records, because it'd be the Swedish New York to LA record and the Swedish LA to New York record and the Swedish double transcontinental record. The record they did not set, though, because it was Nick Wesley and Chris Michaels. Previously, Mark Spence was the third man. So they did not set the record for a team of three doing a transcontinental record who changed out their third team member. That record is actually held by us because it was me and Arnie and Berkeley, and then Berkeley got switched for Dunedel. So unfortunately they didn't set.
Ethan, did you let Doug have coffee before recording today? We agreed to not let this happen.
I followed every bit of that.
Okay, our flop of the week. A Ferrari SF90 owner was looking to trade their vehicle into, I believe, Earth Motor Cars. This one went viral as well.
Yes. So they want to trade in an SF90 that they're 200K underwater on.
I remember when a Ferrari was 200K.
I know. Like, whoa, that's a lot of cars, actually.
Yeah.
On a three-year-old C8. So it seems like... I'm pulling some of this data from the Jalopnik article on it. They financed the entire purchase price and had like a $10,000 a month car payment, which is...
It's like 770 grand they bought it
for.
Which, come on, people, that's... we've been talking about this market. You got to know when stuff is overpriced.
And he still owes $690,000 and some change.
Oh, gosh.
He had to take out a loan to pay his rent because his working situation changed. He's not pulling in the same amount of money.
That's when you just let the car get repoed and they'll sue you later for the difference. Yeah, I'm like, sort it out. Pay your bills. Pay your rent.
Oh, my gosh.
Let the Ferrari go. But, yeah, he was trying to trade down to a Corvette C8, which is like 80 grand. But... he wants to roll 200K negative equity in. Bro, ain't no bank on the planet giving you a 300% loan to value ratio.
But don't worry. He just says he wants another sports car to drive because he has to keep a certain kind of image.
Mm.
Ugh.
Mm. Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.